海紧缺人才培训工程教学系列丛书、上海英语口译岗位资格证书考试、高级听力教程第三版，由上海外语音像出版社、上海外语电子出版社录制出版。第三盒，
Unit 5, Part 1, Population in the European Union. 2. Exercises. A. Here is a passage about populations in some European countries. Listen and then supply the missing information in the following chart.
In 1991, the population of Belgium was 2.9% of the total European Union.And the now unified Germany's was 22.9%. France had a lower population of 16.3%, and Ireland's was quite small, only 1%. British population was similar to that of France, 16.7%.
B. You are going to hear five sentences, which all contain fractions or percentages.Listen and then complete the following sentences. 1. Last year our turnover went up by nearly a quarter to £70,000. And if we take away the cost of renting the premises...
2. Only a few more kilometres and we're nearly two-thirds of the way home.
3. If you computerised the pay section...You could divide at least 50% of the work with the accounts department.
4. Look, by car the journey's going to take 2 hours. It'll take me 3 times that by train. The connections are so bad.
5. Something must be wrong. Nearly a quarter of our petty cash goes in photocopying, and if we add the salesman's restaurant bills, there's nothing left for stamps.C. Here is a commentary on unemployment among men in the USA. Listen carefully and complete the commentary. The unemployment situation for men in the USA steadily improved between 1982 and 1989. In 1982, the rate of unemployment stood at almost 5%,but fell to just over 4% in 1984. By 1989, it was getting on for 2%, but began to rise around that time. By 1991, the figure stood at approximately 3.5%. The unemployment rate for USA men was well below that shown for European men during this period.In fact, it was roughly 2% lower in 1991. Part 2. Where to find a hospital bed? 3. Exercises. A. Here is a chart showing the number of hospital beds per 100,000 inhabitants in different countries. Some of the information has been left out.Now, listen carefully and supply the missing information.
Well, those were the basic trends. Now, do you have any questions?
Yes. What about the situation in Italy?
The Italian ratio was slightly lower than the European Union average of about 1,000 beds per 100,000 people.
How about Northern Europe, the Netherlands, for example?
Well, the Dutch ratio of slightly over 1,200 beds per 100,000 people was far higher than the average in 1988, while Sweden had the largest number of beds available. The figure there was over 1,400, very high compared with Denmark, where it was only 680.
I am rather surprised about the States. Do you know why the ratio is so low?
A good question. Many of you may be surprised to know that you'll find a hospital bed much more easily in the majority of the European Union countries than in the USA, where the ratio of beds was considerably lower than the European Union average in the region of 600 beds per 100,000 people.
B. Now listen to a continuation of the conversation where the speaker is talking about the situation in the United States and supply the missing information.
Of course, we can only guess at the real reason why the situation in the States is a great deal worse than in a country like Sweden. There is far more government control of the hospital network in Scandinavia than in America, although it's surprising that the United Kingdom, where the government also has a strong control of the health service, has a much lower number of beds than a country like Germany.
Part 3. Television ownership. 2. Exercises. A. Here is a chart showing the number of televisions per 100 inhabitants in different countries. Some information has been left out. Now listen to the passage and supply the missing information. There are quite a few surprises when we look at the chart of the number of TVs per 100 inhabitants for the countries shown. For example, although Denmark is a relatively small country, its ratio of 37 TV sets for every 100 inhabitants was higher than that for France. And then, despite its reputation for technology, the ratio for Japan of 58 per 100 was substantially lower than that for the USA. What's more, the number of channels available doesn't seem to have much effect on TV ownership. Italy had many more channels than Ireland. Nevertheless, they both had a ratio of around 25 TVs per 100. Most European countries had between 30 and 40 TVs per 100, while, unsurprisingly, the USA was out in front with a ratio of over 80 TVs to every 100 inhabitants. B. Listen again and supply the missing words and phrases in the following sentences from the passage. Part 4. Volvo earnings. 3. Exercises. Listen to a passage about a rise in Volvo's earnings and complete the information missing from the report below.
Volvo earnings rise by 11% in first quarter. Volvo, the Swedish automotive, energy and food group, increased its profits by 10.9% in the first quarter of this year, despite a fall of 5% in group turnover. Profits after financial items rose to 2.45 billion Swedish krona, $345 million, compared with 2.21 billion Swedish krona in the first quarter of last year. The group was helped by a 215 million Swedish krona foreign exchange gain on loans, compared with a gain of 30 million Swedish krona a year earlier, as well as by interest earnings of 109 million Swedish krona, compared with 77 million Swedish krona in the first quarter of last year. Operating profits were virtually unchanged at 2.13 billion Swedish krona compared with 2.1 billion Swedish krona in the first quarter of last year. Volvo expects to make a productivity gain this year of at least 5%. The group's liquid funds, inflated by the record profits of the past 2 years, climbed to 18.25 billion Swedish krona by the end of the first quarter from 14.4 billion Swedish krona a year earlier. Volvo profits, at least in the short term, have been hedged against the impact of the falling dollar, but the lower dollar exchange rate shows clearly in the group's sales figures. Volvo turnover fell 5% to 20.6 billion Swedish krona from 21.8 billion Swedish krona in the first 3 months of last year, despite a substantial rise in the volume of car sales.
Part 5. Have you ever called a place for help or information? 2. Exercises. Many businesses use recordings to save time and money, especially after office hours. You are going to hear several recordings of this type. After you hear each recording, fill in the missing information. Have you ever called a place for help or information and gotten a recording? What was the place? What did the recording say? Many businesses use recordings to save time and money, especially after office hours. You are going to hear several recordings of this type. After each recording, fill in the missing information.
This is Pacific Telephone. Our business office is open 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. We are closed weekends and holidays. If you need repair service, please call 611. If you need new service, please refer to your local directory for the phone center nearest you. Thank you.
You have reached the Electric Company Emergency Service. Our regular telephone business hours are 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If this is an emergency, please stay on the line. Your call will be handled in the order received.
Thank you for calling the Music Center information line. Our hours are 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday and Sundays from 12 a.m. to 6 p.m. This is the correct number for information on all events at the Music Center except the Bell Theater. For the Bell Theater, call 972-7654. For more information, stay on the line. Your call will be answered shortly. Thank you.
This is the Auto Club After Hours Emergency Center. For travel and weather information, please call during regular business hours between 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. For emergency roadside service, please hold on. A counselor will be available soon.
This is University Hospital information. Most offices are closed now. To reach hospital emergency services, dial 825-1491. For emergency police service, dial 825-1411. For hospital patient information, dial 825-8611. For other hospital information, dial 825-9111.
Part 6. Listening and Translation. 2. Exercises. A. Sentence Translation. Listen and translate each sentence you hear into Chinese. Then write it in the space provided below. 1. It's staying cloudy tonight with a 40% chance of rain or drizzle. And tomorrow it's going to start dry with bright spells.
2. Reports are coming in of an earthquake in a small town 50 miles north of Sydney, and damages are said to be extensive.
3. Successful foreign policy requires not only military strength, but judicious use of that strength along with economic, political, and social assets that build friendships for cooperative efforts to shape a better world.
4. Most of us tend to believe that competition is good and that competition fairly handled can generally stimulate more efficiency in production, greater efforts to improve products, and lower prices for consumers.
5. Many have said that the U.S. may be physically winning the war on terror, but that it is losing the war of information. Would you agree with that statement? B. Passage translation. Listen and translate each passage you hear into Chinese, then write it in the space given below. You may take notes while you are listening.
1. I came into economics asking the question, what makes for a good society? And that means, what makes for good public policy? And also, what's the role of a government? It's clear that a government has a tremendous role to play. A stable government provides real law, is self-disciplined and self-limiting according to law, provides a stable set of monetary and financial institutions so the money really means something, and helps to create an environment of knowledge and innovation in this society. It also guarantees the access to education, primary health, and so forth.
2. I experienced a community of people who worked hard, but always with plenty of laughter and singing. These people were dirt poor by Western standards, with no running water, electricity, or any other modern convenience. Yet they displayed tremendous joy in their lives, with their keen sense of humor and their liking for dancing and drumming till the early hours of the morning. I learned a powerful lesson that would continue to impress me for decades to come. Happiness is not dependent on material wealth. And it was this lesson that eventually led me to question the American dream. A dream of gaining as much money, power, and status as humanly possible.
Unit 6, Part 1, Inquiring About a Job. 2. Exercises. A. Sue has decided that she would like to change her job and sees an advert in her local newspaper. Here is a telephone conversation between Sue and John Adams, the personnel manager of the company. Now listen and fill in the notes which Sue wanted to find out. Hello, Woolworths.
Hello. I wonder if I could speak to the personnel manager, please.
Yes, certainly. If you hold on a minute, I'll put you through.
Thank you.
Hello, John Adams speaking.
Good morning, Mr. Adams. I saw your advertisement in the Saffron Walden Reporter for a hostess.
Oh, yes.
And I wondered if you could give me a few more details about the job.
Yes, certainly. Perhaps I should make it clear from the start that it is a part-time job. Yes, we would need you from 10 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon, roughly.
Yes, yes. I didn't realize that, actually. It wasn't clear in the advertisement.
Uh-huh. Are you still interested?
Well, I am interested, but it would depend to some extent on what the salary is.
Yes, well, we're offering about £75 a week. Obviously, this may be a little bit more if you have the right qualifications and experience. Have you, in fact, had any experience in catering?
Well, yes, I have. I'm at present working for, and have been working for, the same firm for about 5 years, for a small firm of consultant engineers. And I've been doing work rather similar to the kind of work that I think is described in the advertisement.
Yes, well, I mean, we have a fairly small staff here. We're talking about 15 to 20 people.
Yes.
So your duties will be sort of to prepare and serve the food just at lunchtimes.
I see. Yes. I'm sure I'd be able to manage that. That wouldn't be a problem.
Yes, well, that sounds about right. Perhaps you could come down for an interview sometime.
Yes, yes. When would be suitable for you?
Let me just have a look at my diary. Yes, perhaps. What about next Wednesday at about 2:30 in the afternoon? Would that be all right for you?
Wednesday, 2:30. Yes, I think that would be fine, actually. That's okay.
Good. Yeah, and perhaps you could bring any qualifications you've got so we could have a look at them and...
Yes, okay.
Could you just tell me who you're working for at the moment?
I'm working for Bloggs's, actually in the High Street.
Right, okay. And could I just have your name?
Yes, my surname is Boardman. That's Boardman. And my initial is S.
Right, okay. S. Boardman. Okay, Miss Boardman. Well, see you then next Wednesday at 2:30.
Okay, thanks very much then.
B. Now listen to the telephone conversation again and fill in John Adams' memo form. C. Read and complete the following mini dialogues using what you remember from the telephone conversation. Now listen again and check your answers against what is said in the recording. Part 2. Astronaut wanted. No experience necessary. 2. Exercises. Listen to the conversation and then choose the best answer to each question you hear at the end of the conversation. Miss Sharman, we all know that you have a place in history as Britain's first astronaut. I don't think any of us has any plans to follow you into space, but we certainly wanted to know how you set about getting yourself into orbit.
I was driving my car home from work. I was trying to listen to some music, really. I was just flicking through the radio stations, finding some light music. And the advert went, "Astronaut wanted, no experience necessary." And it then went on to describe that the Russians had offered the opportunity to somebody from the United Kingdom to train and then to blast off on one of their rockets and to do experiments in space. I thought, wow, yes, this is something I really want to do, because I had never thought about being an astronaut before that. I mean, nobody tells you at school that if you study sciences and keep up with your languages, then maybe one day you can be an astronaut.
It was an immediate decision, in fact, was it?
Absolutely. I mean, I did chemistry at university. I'd been an engineer and then a technologist, and I enjoyed my job very much. I'd never thought about being an astronaut. There was never the opportunity for anybody from this country to be an astronaut. Now, maybe if I'd grown up in Russia or America, maybe that would have been an ambition. But there was no chance, as far as I was concerned, when I was a child.
You had some of the right qualifications they'd been looking for, though.
They wanted a scientist or a technologist, primarily, and the job was to do experiments in space. I mean, that was the prime job. And of course, the training and the launch and the weightlessness and looking back at the Earth, all of those things are extras. The actual job was to do experiments in space, so we had to be scientists.
Also, it had to be someone who was extremely fit, even before you went through their programs. I mean, were you a sportswoman?
Yes, we had to be. Like, internally healthy and already of a certain standard of fitness. But really, I mean, I love swimming and cycling and running, that kind of fitness, the aerobic stuff. And of course, what the Russians wanted to train me to do was to have big muscles. I had to be very strong. I put on 3 kilos over my shoulders and arms, really, so that I could operate effectively in a spacesuit. It was a different kind of thing than I was used to, a different kind of fitness. I mean, it's no good having somebody who likes to run marathons on board a space station. You can't go very far.
13,000 people applied for this job.
Yes. Initially, of course, I had no idea when I applied how many other people would also apply. But when I discovered that 13,000 others also had applied, I thought that I just didn't stand a chance. I really was in two minds whether I should just pull out and forget the whole thing, but something made me just keep on going.
Questions. 1. What nationality is the woman being interviewed?
2. What did the woman study at university?
3. What was the woman's job at the time she decided to apply to be an astronaut?
4. In the interview, the woman mentioned she liked sports. Which of the following is not one that she mentioned?
5. How many applicants were there for the job of astronaut? Part 3. Their jobs. 2. Exercises. A. Listen to three people describing their jobs and write down what you think they do. Also write down any words which helped you to decide.
Extract 1. I come into work at 8 o'clock, and the first thing I do is collect my keys. Then I go down to the common room. I sweep and I wash the floor, and I also check the toilets, and when there's no students in the classrooms, I empty the bins and do the rooms. And I also help over the canteen when the girl is off to do teas and coffees. And I usually sweep the stairs and then wash them again, and I leave off at 2 o'clock. What I particularly hate is having to be at work at a certain time and leave off at a certain time, and have to work to a pattern all the while. And also, I do hate cigarette ends and dirty tissues about the floor. I think there's nothing more degrading than somebody got to pick a dirty tissue up that someone's used, and also to pick cigarette ends up that have been in other people's mouths. If I was to get paid for every dog end I picked up, I would be a rich lady. What I like about my job is I am free and easy. I work on my own, and so if I want to do something this day, I do it, and if I want to do something the next day, I do it. I find the students very, very friendly. They will come and talk to you in their breaks or any spare time, and they will tell you about their country, and it's very, very interesting. Extract 2. The hours really aren't very regular, although I work every day of the week, Monday to Friday. But I don't start at 9 till 5, that sort of hours, because I don't work in an office. I work from home. Having said that, some of the hours can be from 7 in the morning till 10 at night, depending on if I get a lot of phone calls during the week. So, having had the phone calls, I've got to go out and see them all over the place. And for that, obviously, I've got to have a car, which the company supplies, and all expenses. Some of the people that I go to see are quite awkward. There are a lot of men. It's a very male-oriented business, and a lot of men still feel that a woman's place is in the home, and she should be tied to the kitchen sink and looking after the children. Any candidate who comes for my type of job has to be outgoing, fairly joyful, cheerful. They've got to be constantly smiling, eyes bright, questions answered, and it's not the easiest of situations if you've had a heavy session the night before.
Extract 3. I don't really have a typical day. All days are different. But on a day for me at work, it would be typical for me to go into my office 8 o'clock and liaise with other people who I work with in my office. On commencing the patrol of my area, the other thing I've got to keep my eye out for, anything unusual in the area, any abandoned motor vehicles that may have been stolen from somewhere else, or indeed anything else that should need my attention. It also involves being seen in shopping areas, areas of schools, busy crossroads, and speaking, as I say, generally speaking, to people, going into shops and finding out if they've got any problems or complaints. Another part of my job is, it doesn't just revolve around crime. It does also involve, traffic regulations, though there are several ways you can go about that job, without always having to take the person before the court. Warnings are often given. You don't want to, as a community PC, it's not wise to upset unnecessarily the people who you want to help you in order to do your job. This you've got to be conscious of all the time, and it takes quite a lot of skill. B. Listen to Extract 1 again and supply the information about the job as it is described in the extract. C. Listen to Extract 2 again and complete the following job description. D. Listen to Extract 3 again and then fill each blank of the following passage with one word only. Part 4. The Changing U.S. Job Market. 2. Exercises. A. Here is a lecture discussing the changing American job market. The following space is provided for you to take short notes on the most important points while you're listening to the lecture. High school and college students in the United States today, as well as others who plan to work in this country, have one important question about their futures. Will they find a job? There is no easy answer, of course, but let's look at some of the recent changes in the U.S. job market and see if we can make some prediction for future job hunters. A good way to begin is to look at the American workforce and how it's changing. The most important change has been the shift from a manufacturing economy to a service economy. Let's define both of these terms. First, a service economy is one in which most workers provide services. That is, they do something, like pumping gas into people's cars, for example, instead of making something. Generally, service jobs are grouped into five categories. 1. Transportation and utility companies, like the phone company. 2. Wholesale companies. 3. Retail companies. 4. Finance, insurance, and real estate companies. And finally, 5. Personal services, such as hotels, car repair, accounting, and medicine. Examples of people who work in service industries include your doctor, your hairstylist, airline pilots, and sales clerks in department stores. In contrast, people who actually produce things, like cars, furniture, or clothing, are part of the manufacturing economy. Now, the point here is that we have changed from a manufacturing economy to a service economy. The following numbers will show you just how much our economy has changed. 100 years ago, 80% of workers produced goods. Today, only about 30% do. Economists predict that by the year 2000, 9 out of every 10 workers will supply services. What has caused this change in our economy? Well, first, manufacturing industries are not growing for one simple reason: competition from Western Europe and Asia. Jobs in American automobile and steel production have especially decreased during the last 10 years. The number of service industries, on the other hand, has increased for several reasons. Because of technological advances, especially in computers and telephone communications, advertising, accounting, and other business services become important. Also, the growing number of married women who work outside the home has increased the need for restaurants and daycare centers. And, as the number of old people has grown, so have health care services. So now you know where the jobs will be, and you've decided to look for a job in a service industry. But wait, because some economists worry that the service job explosion may create several problems. According to some studies, Americans' standard of living might decrease because half of the service jobs pay low wages. For example, 3 out of 5 new jobs between 1979 and 1985 paid less than $7,000 a year. The pay is low because many of these jobs don't require much education or training, and many of the workers are part-time or temporary employees. Companies save money by using temporary employees because they don't have to give them health insurance or vacation pay. Such jobs give a worker very little security. The good news is that, as you can see in the chart, the fastest-growing service job categories are the better-paying ones, particularly in the technological and computer-related fields. But these jobs require a high degree of skill and many years of education. So if you decide to look for a job in a service industry and you want to be sure you'll make enough money, getting the right training and education first is the best way to prepare for the future job market. B. Listen again. Add more information to your notes. Then use your notes to fill in the following outline. Part 5. As the saying goes, time is money. 2. Exercise. Now listen to a man talking about his office life and then choose the best answer to each question you hear.
First of all, when do people start to work in American offices?
Right. Well, the official workday starts at 9 a.m. This should really mean 9 o'clock, not 10 past or half past 9.
Would you say that people work very hard in offices in America?
Well, I don't know about employees in your country, but some nations have a philosophy that you work when the boss is around, and any time he's not there, one can relax by reading the newspaper or whatever one likes doing in a personal way.
And things are different in the States, you're saying?
Well, in America, one is being paid for your time, so employees are expected to find other work if their own desks are clear, or to help someone else with his or her work. But you never sit idle or do nothing.
Yes, as the saying goes, time is money.
Exactly. Your employer owns your time while he is paying you for it. That is precisely what time is money means. And anyway, the boss doesn't ask more of you than he is doing himself. He will probably work through the lunch hour himself and even take work home at night.
Talking about lunch hours, what about them? Do you have to take them seriously?
Oh yes, sure, of course. The employee's lunch hour should be taken within the period allowed, unless you're officially discussing company business, say, on a business lunch. It's the same, too, with the end of the day. I mean, work until the day officially ends at 5 o'clock, unless you're in an office where flex time is the accepted practice.
Oh, so you have the flexi time system, do you? I wasn't sure about that.
Oh, yes, sure. Flexible working hours, that is, starting or ending work earlier or later. I know that this is very common in Europe, but here in the USA, it is still relatively new. Certainly, there are 1 million or so Americans on the system today, and the number is growing. Well, for the same reasons as in Europe, to keep traffic and commuting problems down. And as more women now work, it gives more family time.
Could you say something about contracts of hiring in America, please?
Well, it's different in America from, say, Asia, perhaps Europe too. I'm not sure. We're more democratic, I think. It means, perhaps, that we don't develop such a permanent relationship between employer and employee. I know that in some countries, people relax when they have once got a job, because they know they will almost never be fired, unless they do something awful.
You mean that your employer can just fire you in America?
No. There are, of course, legal protections in the USA, so employees cannot be unjustly fired without good reason. Workers must do a good job, produce well, and get along with their colleagues, or they can be let go, as it is called.
From one day to the next, you mean?
Well, it's rarely done without warning, but it is important to remember that in the United States, you are a member of a business firm and not a family. It makes a difference.
I wonder, is the physical or external appearance of office life different from European offices?
Well, I have heard people comment on the informality found in American offices. And this is certainly a little difficult for people who are more used to a hierarchical system to adjust to, of course. But there are some very formal offices, too, say in big banks, law firms, and major corporations. But in many establishments, the atmosphere is loose and easy, with a lot of joking and teasing and wandering in and out of offices among all levels of employees.
Well, that's about it, I think. Oh, except to briefly mention all those coffee breaks I've heard about in the United States.
Uh-huh, that's right. Nearly all large offices have coffee wagons that circulate for mid-morning and mid-afternoon coffee breaks. But you should remember that although 15 minutes are allotted twice a day for relaxation and chatter, many employees take coffee to their desks and keep on working. In small offices, the coffee pot is often on all day, and employees take coffee whenever they like, or they can make tea for themselves. It all depends.
Questions. 1. When does the official workday start in American offices?
2. How many minutes a day are the coffee breaks in large American offices?
3. What does flexi time mean?
4. According to the conversation, which of the following statements is true?
5. Generally, what is the conversation about?
Part 6. Listening and Translation. 2. Exercises. A. Sentence Translation. Listen and translate each sentence you hear into Chinese, then write it in the space provided below.
1. This is the most serious hurricane to have hit the Pacific Island in the past 10 years, and we'll give you the details as it comes in.
2. Police figures show that computer crimes are on the increase, with 98 reported so far this year, compared with 37 in 1998 and 72 in 1999.
3. We would like to see, from the astronaut's point of view, that people take good care of the Earth and replace the resources that have been used.
4. So, I think that most countries in the world see Canada as a peaceful nation, and I don't think that it is ever going to affect your national security in a negative way.
5. One of the big things that you referred to is the gap between the rich countries and the poor countries. Give us an idea of how extreme that gap is.
B. Passage Translation. Listen and translate each passage you hear into Chinese, then write it in the space given below. You may take notes while you are listening.
1. The pay negotiations were going badly. We wanted to link the pay increase to the productivity level, but the unions refused. They wouldn't budge. We finally reached a point where they were threatening to go on strike. We sacked all the employees. We sent out letters to everyone saying that their employment would cease on a certain date. Then we offered them new employment contracts, which linked a pay rise to productivity. One by one, they all gave in and signed on the dotted line. 2. I had achieved the so-called American dream to a large extent by my late 30s. My husband and I lived in Los Angeles, where I practiced law. I earned a six-figure income and enjoyed the expensive clothes and vacations that my salary afforded. I was respected in my profession. But after 10 years of practicing law, I started to question everything. What kind of contribution was I making to society? How would I feel at retirement looking back on my career? After considerable soul-searching and journal writing, I concluded that I did not want to spend the next 30 years of my life helping people fight each other.
Unit 7. Part 1. London. 3. Exercises. Listen to a passage about London and fill in the following blanks with what you hear from the recording.
London, capital of England, is one of the most cosmopolitan cities in the world. With its population of Indians, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, Africans, West Indians, Cypriots, Chinese, and many more, it is in some ways as much a Commonwealth city as a British international centre for tourism. The tourist season in London, which used to be mainly in the summer months, is now all year round, and of the 15 million people who visit Britain each year, most spend at least a few days in London. But London is more than this. It is the centre of government and the home of the Queen. It is also the financial centre of Britain. When people talk about the city, they are referring not to London itself, but to a small area called the City of London. The City of London contains the Stock Exchange, the Bank of England, and all the major financial institutions. London was originally established by the Romans, who chose the site of Londonium for its good trading and defensive position. When the Romans left, Winchester became the capital of England until the 13th century, when administration was moved to London. London's growth in the Middle Ages brought overcrowding, lack of sanitation, and unhealthy conditions. Outbreaks of bubonic plague, the Black Death, were very common. In 1666, the Great Fire of London destroyed much of the city. Many of London's finest buildings date from the subsequent period of intensive planning and rebuilding. St. Paul's Cathedral is only one example. The 18th and 19th centuries saw London's growth as an international centre of trade and finance. During the 20th century, London's international importance had declined. Today, it has to compete as a financial centre with New York, Tokyo, and other major capitals.
Part 2. About a London taxi driver. 3. Exercises. Here is a conversation between Chris and John, a taxi driver in London. Listen and then decide whether the following statements are true, T, or false, F.
The law on taxis is very interesting, and I know in London it's different from other places, and rules are quite strict, aren't they?
Any London cab driver does a thing called... It's called the knowledge, and it's a basic test of 468 runs, what they call runs, from a blue book.
And the idea is that anybody can get into a taxi anywhere in London and give the driver a destination, and he's got to know the way there.
That's the basis of the knowledge, finding anywhere from point A to B in that 6 mile radius in London.
Is it difficult to learn the knowledge?
Average, it took me 19 months. Now it's taking guys 3 years because they want... I mean, you've got to have a medical, you're checked out by the police, you do the knowledge, but after you've done the basic knowledge, there are still some exams to do. It can take anywhere now from 2 to 3 years, and then you do a driving test at the end.
I get the impression they're very strict about taxis. Quite apart from the knowledge, there's the licence. Do you have to have a licence every year?
The licence is renewed 3 years, but for your cab, whether you rent it or you own it, it has to have a yearly overhaul, which is a very strict passing test, and there are some real stringent tests you've got to pass.
Is it really worth it all?
Yeah, I think it's worth it. I enjoy being a taxi driver, and not only that, it does keep the standard very high, which is what we want in London.
Do you feel proud to be a Londoner? Were you born in London?
No, I was actually born in Bristol, but I came up to London when I was 12.
Do you think of yourself as a Bristolian or a Londoner?
A few people think I'm still a country boy because I've still got that accent in me. I haven't really got a typical London Cockney accent, but I see myself as a Londoner definitely now because I've been up here a lot longer.
What do you do in your spare time?
Well, I'm into bodybuilding. That takes up quite a good deal of my spare time, basically.
How much time?
I might do a system of 3 days training with a day off, followed by another 3 days training and a day off.
Where do you go to train?
I train at Ultra Sport Gym. That's up in Norwood.
Forgive my ignorance, but are we talking about some of Mr. Universe here? With you standing up in front of an audience and playing music and putting oil on your body and all that sort of thing. Is that the kind of bodybuilding you do?
Well, when you get seriously into the sport, building your body, all areas of your body, so on a Monday, for example, you might just train your chest and your triceps, and on the Tuesday you might, I don't know, your back and legs. You split your body up.
Are they just weights, or do you have a lot of gadgets?
We've got machines up there, but it's not a high-gloss, you know, sort of fitness centre that you see some other gyms have got. It has a lot of free weights.
Do you have somebody supervising your training?
No, I train with two other regular partners. Part 3. An American in London. 3. Exercises. A. Matthew is an American student from Boston, who is spending a year at a college in London. Listen to an interview with him and then answer, which of the following statements best sums up Matthew's attitude to Britain?
What were the things in Britain that you found most strange when you first arrived?
Well, the first thing is driving on the wrong side of the road. That was very strange, because you have this automatic reflex when you go out into the street to look one way, and a couple of times I did that, and I almost got hit by cars and bikes and all, you know. It's dangerous. It really is dangerous. And you have to teach yourself to look the other way.
Someone said that Britain and the United States are divided by a common language. Have you had any difficulties with the language here?
Oh, yeah. Tremendous amount of difficulty, but I'm starting to pick it up now. All the lingo and slang and all those. But there's definitely a difference.
Can you give me some examples?
Well, I'd say some of the biggest ones would be the word queue, which means in America line. I never heard the word queue before. What you call chips, I call French fries. I never heard them called chips. There's so many words that are different. Are crisps, which mean potato chips. Yeah, we call them potato chips or chips in America. You call them crisps here. So when I heard the word chips, I was thinking of crisps. It's very confusing. But just some of the expressions like mate, you know, and love, they're funny. You don't hear them. You don't hear them in America.
What about with young people, with people your own age? I mean, do you notice differences there?
I do notice some differences. I think the younger people in Britain they seem to be much more radical than the younger people in the United States. I notice that. The dress is different. I see a lot of males here with earrings in one of their ears. You don't see that in America that much. Some, maybe here and there, but not like you see it here. So many of the young people wear black clothing. You don't see the other colors. At home, you see all different types of bright colors. And in England, you see so much black, especially on the women.
You don't like that?
Not really. It's just my own preference. I'd rather see different colors here and there, not all one color. Everyone looks like Madonna.
When you say radical, are you just thinking of clothes or of anything else?
No, I think radical is in going against the norms. Could you say, not only in clothing, but I think in politics too, whereas in America you don't find that as much. Oh, also, another difference is the younger people they're more politically aware on a larger level. See, a lot of the Americans, they're aware of government of the United States and maybe a few other countries, but not as many countries in Europe, or they just have a vague understanding of how those other countries are run, not as widespread, whereas here, I think that they, the kids, get to know about how different countries are run at a much younger level. And they know all about the United States and how it's run.
What do you think the reasons are for that?
That's a good question. I think that the reasons are just because of the press. You hear so much about America here that people they're into it. They want to know what it's about and how it's run. And so many of our policies in America affect Britain that they want to understand how policies are made and all that. they can affect us. But not to as great an extent, and therefore you don't hear as much about Britain and people don't know as much about it. B. Listen to the interview again. Complete the following chart with the examples Matthew gives of the differences between British and American English. C. Listen again and complete the notes in the chart below. Write one word only in each gap. That is the end of the tape.
Life.